Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anazal Ministries podcast.
Bangarang, Rufio! Hello, Systematic Geekology. We are the priests of the geeks. I am one of your hosts, Kevin Schaefer. And we are here with another episode of our Rotten Film Drive-In series, where we look at movies that have a 30% or less rating on Rotten Tomatoes and talk about whether we think they deserve that or whether they don't. Spoiler alert on this one. I think this is a crime that this movie is on that list. We'll get into that. But if you could not tell from the opening quote, we are going to be talking about the 1991 classic Hook with Robin Williams and Dustin Hoffman about the grown-up Peter Pan. I am very excited to talk about this one. And if you want to check out the show notes for, you can see the playlist of this whole series. So there's some really good episodes in this one we've done. I was just listening to one that TJ and Laura did on the 2000 Scooby-Doo or 2002. And then we've done Green Lantern. Evan and I did Fantastic Four, the 2005 one. So a lot of really fun ones in this series. And we get to really do an introspective look at these movies and see what we think of them. So a lot of fun. But yes, I am Kevin Schaefer, and I am here with Evan Garcia. Evan, how are you today?
Doing well, Kevin. Thank you. Yes, I too am shocked that we're sitting here today reviewing this film under these circumstances. It seems criminal.
It just we're going to get into, and I'll go ahead and say up front, I have like a special really love for this movie. So I'm maybe a little biased, but I can look at things objectively. And I just think, we'll get into more thoughts here. But yes, I have a hard time even listing this under the category of rotten films. We have reviewed some genuinely bad movies that in this series that definitely deserve to be in this criteria. I do not think this is one of them. So we'll get into that. But let's go ahead and jump into. So yes, Hook is a movie that came out in 1991. As I said, it is about the grown-up Peter Pan, played by Robin Williams, who he does not remember that he ever was Peter Pan. He's now an adult, he has a family, and he knows that he was an orphan, but he really doesn't remember anything about his childhood before he came into the care of Granny Wendy, who is, of course, the older version of Wendy from the classic Peter Pan story. But he only really knows her as the woman who helped raise him. And so now he's an adult, he's very much a business workaholic. This is a classic 90s trope of the father figure being so consumed by work and being distant from his kids and all that. So it starts off with that, and him, his wife, and his two kids, Jack and Maggie, they go to London to actually visit Granny Wendy while she is being honored for all her years-long contributions running an orphanage and, giving kids like, his name is Peter Banning here. Again, he doesn't know who he is, Peter Pan. And so he's one of many kids who was given, a home and an upbringing because of Wendy. And so they're honoring her. And while this is going on, the kids are kidnapped by Captain Hook. So Captain Hook enters the world of London, leaves and comes, kidnaps them. And this is when Wendy reveals to Peter who he really is. And he, and at first he doesn't believe it, you know, he's, but then, you know, in a desperation to save his kids, he is whisked away to Neverland by Tinkerbell, played by Julia Roberts. And when they get there, he just wants to get his kids and get back. But Captain, we find the Captain Hook, played by Dustin Hoffman, is bent on revenge and bent on this epic war he wants between him and Peter so he can get his revenge and he can have this epic duel. But he comes to learn that, you know, Peter Pan has forgotten who he is. He's just this, you know, middle-aged dude who has no, he doesn't know how to fly. He doesn't know how to fight. He doesn't know how to do anything. And Captain Hook is now just like reluctant to do anything. And he wants to just, you know, kill off him and the kids. Tinkerbell then convinces him to give him 3 days or give her 3 days to train Peter, get him back in shape, and they could have their big epic battle and, you know, Captain Hook could be happy. And so Captain Hook reluctantly agrees and he keeps the kids on board while Peter Tinkerbell goes and trains him. A lot of stuff other happens. There is now a new leader of the Lost Boys named Rufio, played by Dante Basco, who I got to meet at GalaxyCon last year.
Great name.
In Avatar Last Airbender. I love Dante Basco. I love Rufio. One of my favorite characters. And so, so needless to say, Rufio is a challenger to Peter. He's reluctant to, you know, hand over his title to, again, this middle-aged guy with no real skills. Mm. And so then the movie plays out as this journey of Peter rediscovering who he is, learning how to fly again, learning how to lead the Lost Boys. And meanwhile, Captain Hook is trying to lure his son, Jack, Peter's son, Jack, over to his side and be kind of the fog in their figure that Peter hasn't been for him all these years. And so he's working on that. And then, you know, the story plays out. They do get the big epic battle at the end. Peter and Rufio reconcile and they fight together. Sadly, Rufio is killed in battle by Captain Hook. And, you know, that further spawns Peter to fight him. They eventually win the battle. There's also a romance thing with him and Tinkerbell, but Tinkerbell's like in love with Peter. So that's explored. And then, yeah, at the end, you know, Peter does become the hero for his kids. They look up to him. And at the very end, he hands over the mantle of Peter Pan to one of the Lost Boys. And then he goes back home with his family. And, you know, I was happy to, there's a lot of other details there, but that's kind of the overview there. So that's just a little bit about, now again, I'll get more into what this movie means to me. But Evan, if we had just left the drive-in theater seeing this movie for the first time, what do you think your reaction would be, or maybe the first thing you would say? I know you had a pretty visceral reaction to Fantastic Four. I think this one will be a little different, but I'm curious. Just what do you think your thoughts would be coming out of the theater?
If it was me right now coming out of the theater, I would have been more of a let's go get some pizza to wash out some of the to kind of make up the time that we kind of missed, but yet we like to talk about it still. Over some pizza.
Okay. Yeah. And I think you bring up a good point too of like, you know, I wasn't quite born yet. I was born in 93. So wasn't quite born when this movie comes out, but it was still a staple of my childhood. So, but I think you bring up a good point in terms of reaction to this movie as a kid, right, and an adult seeing this for the first time would be very different. That's why it's kind of hard for me to look at this movie objectively. I'm trying to try. But again, this was a favorite of mine as a child and for many years, and it stayed with me all these years. I watched it so many times on VHS. Kids, if you don't know, VHS was this thing where you had a tape of a movie you put into a player. It was the predecessor to DVDs.
Be Kind Rewind.
We got it on DVD. Yes, Be Kind Rewind. Oh, the best. Like, and actually, if you go to Alamo Draft House, like the one in Raleigh that I have, like they have a VHS player there that you can rent.
Oh, right on. This film was huge for me because I was like 5 or 6 when this came out. I remember seeing it in theaters, like watching the clips because I couldn't watch the whole film. I had too much going on, so I watched some clips of it, and it just came flooding back to me. Like, I remember who I was with, what theater. I remember the car ride after I was like, I got to get myself a Rufio toy or something like that because his hair was badass. And just like,
oh, it was the best.
It was great. It was great. And the Rufio, Rufio, Rufio,
Rufio.
And then the alligator falling on Hook like that.
Yes.
That's something that's always been burned into my brain for some reason. So yeah, this is a memorable film. I get it that it could, that sometimes that's not enough to make it a good film. But from what I was watching, and now as an adult and seeing your recap of it, I relate to it just a little bit differently. And it's not bad. It's just different.
It is. And that's the thing. I think I would have a different reaction if I was seeing this for the first time as a 31-year-old versus, sure, you know, when I was, yeah, a kid growing up on it. And when I was a kid, too, Peter Pan was my favorite Disney movie and character. Now, that's one, like, perception that has changed because there are some horribly outdated, very racist stereotypes that I was not cognizant of as a kid. That's a whole other topic. Right. But still, Peter Pan was my favorite. I always loved the story. I love the story of, you know, the kid who didn't grow up and, you know, he's fighting pirates and he's going on adventures with all the Lost Boys. So that always, you know, was really captured my imagination. And then seeing this movie at a young age, too, it was very much a reverence to that classic story by J.M. Barrie. And this is a Spielberg movie, so it has that sense of wonder and magic to it that so many of his other classics have. And, you know, and again, looking at it objectively, yes, can I see faults here? Absolutely. I mean, does this movie need to be 2.5 hours? I don't think so. You know, and really? There's a lot, wow, of like, yeah, it could. Yeah, it is almost 200. It's almost 2.5 hours. There's like, I mean, it's a good 40 minutes in the opening before we get to Neverland. There's a lot, you know, at the beginning where, you know, it's, I said earlier that one of the biggest 90s tropes was the workaholic father.
Mm-hmm. Santa Claus and all that. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The Santa, mm-hmm, Claus. I mean, Jumanji. Which is,
yeah,
funny because,
that's right.
Like, because, yeah. Which Robin Williams, mm-hmm, was, and of course, and you know, and it wasn't, you know, his character, but it was like his father, mm-hmm, when he's, mm-hmm, a kid. He had that. So like this was a trope, and they established it early on. I feel like they hammer it in a little too much. Like it's like, okay, we get it. You know, you're distant from your kids. You're you know, ignoring while, you know, they have these years with them to really spend that quality time. So that's kind of like pretty ham-fisted, and then. Yeah, it takes a minute for the Captain Hook scene to happen, and then for the Tinkerbell to show up and him and Peter to go to Neverland. So, yeah, there is a lot you could cut down here. I also, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting, I can't remember where I saw this. It was a quote from somewhere where someone said, like, this movie is like a musical that it should have been a musical, and it has all the tenets of one, but there's no musical. Like,
I could see that. It has like the heart. I could see that too.
It has the heart, mm-hmm, of a musical, and you know, the structure of it really well. You could very much see these moments of dramatic weight where they bust into song, mm-hmm, and then it doesn't happen, you know? And I think like that actually, you know, that got me thinking, I'm like, that would have been really interesting, you know, because Spielberg to this day has only ever done one musical adaptation. That was West Side Story a few years ago, which I highly recommend. Mm-hmm. It's a great movie. Mm-hmm. But this one, I think, could have been that, you know, the script really lends itself to that genre really well. But again, I do have like a really fun connection with this movie. Again, I grew up on it. I just, you know, and actually, right. Okay. So, Evan, before we started recording and you said that you didn't get a chance to rewatch this recently, I recommended one scene in particular that I think, you know, always gets me, and it also really captures the tone of the movie. And that is the scene when Peter is at the dinner table with all the Lost Boys, and he's like so hungry. He's like, oh, I can't wait, you know, and it looks like all this food is being prepared. And then they open the plates and there's nothing there, but all the Lost Boys are like looking like they're eating and they're digging in. They're like, come on, Peter, eat up, you know, like, eat. And he's like, mm-hmm, what are you talking about? Like, Gandhi ate more than this, you know, like, he's like, and it builds up to, they have this, like, insult contest between Peter and Rufio. And then what happens is, it's Peter starts to unlock his imagination, And then the food shows up in his mind. And you realize, like, that's the magic of Neverland, that it's all based on imagination and this childlike wonder. And that is, I think, captures the tone of the movie so well. And you said after watching that scene, that's what brought memories back for you.
For sure, for sure. And it also brought the two parts of me together, like the little six-year-old that's obsessed and he's just only worried about the Little Caesars that we're going to eat on the way home. You know, it's like, and then the middle-aged dad with the job and the mortgage and all that. It kind of blended both together, and I could see it from both sides, and I could relate to Pete and be like, there are times where I have to remember and to not force myself, but to remind myself that sometimes it's good to have a childlike perspective on things, and you can use your imagination. Things don't have to be so literal and so so buttoned down and so perfect. So that kind of that was a good spot for me to see. That was a good clip for me to see and to resonate, and to see how that's resonated with me now and how I see it as a kid when I was younger. So, I wanted to know that the frosting they used looked so delicious. I want to go get a cake right now.
Dude, the food there just looks amazing all around. Yeah. Like once it does come on screen, it's just like, it's so disruptive. And that we'll get into later when we do our question about, you know, what snack would you have?
This
movie. And again, you know, I think one of the things about Spielberg, definitely, is that, you know, he's either loved or ignored for his overt use of sentimentality. And this is very much a sentimental
and
movie.
The sound effects and the zooming in.
Yes. And I mean, like, again, I think I just, between watching this movie as a kid and seeing some of my Spielberg movies, I don't mind that. I think, you know, Spielberg does sentimentality like no one else. And so it works here. But I can see that as a criticism where, you know, you get a critic here who, especially if, like, because this was, let's see, a couple years before Jurassic Park. This is obviously after E.T. But I can see a lot of critics here giving this a low score alone for just the overt use of sentimentality and pulling at your heartstrings. Because it does that relentlessly. And you know that, you know, at the end, of course, Jack is going to, you know, reunite with Peter. It's, you know, it's not going to have some dark ending there. Like, he's going to rediscover himself and, you know, there, and he's going to run into his kids and all that. So, you know, all that is in the works, and, you know, you have the John Williams score and everything else, and it, you know, it all comes together. But, you know, I do think there are probably other reasons why it got a low score. I still, you know, again, I don't think this deserves to be in the category of, like, rotten film, because there are issues with the movie. It's not a perfect script by any means. Like, you know, I'd say more so it doesn't need to be this long. You know, there's things you can edit and make tighter. And it is a lot of emotion and sentimentality. But to have this at a, what is it, 29% tomato meter right here, that to me is absurd. I just think that critics just were really reluctant to, you know, allow themselves to feel anything at all and appreciate the, you know, the family themes of the movie and how it is a really good action adventure one. And it, you know, and it captures the story of Peter Pan really well. So I think it is overly criticized. Are there issues with it? Sure. But I could see this being more of a, like, mid-range movie to critics rather than a failure.
Now, might be a stupid question, but these ratings are, like, modern day ratings. They're not from 30 years ago, right?
Well, it's a collection of, like, all the way. So on Rotten Tomatoes, and this is not, I mean, so this is my other thing, is, like, I'm not a fan of Rotten Tomatoes at all, and I think it's been like one of the worst things for movie culture because it assigns an algorithm to a movie rather than allow people to just feel what they want and develop their own opinions about a movie.
Gotcha.
It just creates this, like, rift. So I hate it as a whole anyway. And I don't really, I never, like, look at Rotten Tomatoes to determine whether I'm going to see a movie or not. Even if a movie is getting bad reviews, I want to see it for myself and really determine that. Mm-hmm. So I hate it in general. But on Rotten Tomatoes, so I'm looking at the page right now. It has a 28% tomato meter based on 65 reviews. I think a lot of those are from back when it came out. Some are more modern. So it's a culmination. But then you look at, see, this is the thing. The audience score, the popcorn meter, is 76%, which, so that tells you right there alone, there is a disparity here between the critical mm-hmm. reception of the movie
yeah.
and the more mainstream reception okay. of it. So I think that's a factor as well. But yeah, I mean, I just hate the algorithm in general and how it, is assigned. I mean, even because you think about it, it's like there are still going to be good reviews in that range there, but they get muddled under, if it's an overwhelmingly negative one, they just get looped in there. And so I don't really like how the scores are presented. But yeah, that, it was not a, critical success by any means. And, I think this is one, I think of another 90s movie too, that also got blasted by critics at the time and is, for a lot of kids who grew up on it, one of the favorites. And that's A Goofy Movie, which there is a whole documentary about that on Disney Plus that's actually really good. And, that was a, very meaningful movie for 90s kids that got absolutely blasted by critics at the time.
Yeah.
And now it's had this enduring legacy. I think Hook is similar to that in respect because, it had a lot of us who grew up on
Robin
it.
Robin Williams.
We loved it. And we had Robin Williams. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, and he brings both his dramatic and comedic chops to the role. Because, he has the scene early on where he yells at his kids because they're interrupting him on a business call. And then, later on, he has all these moments as Peter Pan where he's flying around and doing all this stuff. And then, and the Use Your Imagination scene. I love the insult, war between him and Rufio. It's classic.
Mm-hmm.
But also, since you brought up the alligator earlier, so this is one of those things too that this is an interesting thing about the effects and the fights and stuff, the action in this movie, because I think from a visual standpoint, there's a lot of really good scenery and imagery here. I really like the aesthetic of Neverland and how you can see the different parts, the pirate ship and the Lost Boys and the mermaids and everything. But I think the fight scenes are probably among the weakest stuff, when they have this alligator statue just come and consume at the end, it is really corny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's iconic for the movie, but it also, that is such, it's such,
it was a choice so much for sure.
It was a choice for sure. Yeah. And, sometimes the comedic aspects undermine some of the more dramatic weights or they don't mesh as well. And so, yeah, that's why I said, again, I get the criticism here. I don't get the overt criticism.
I don't see that. Sure, there are, it's heavy handed, but it still fits within the story because that's the whole point of the story mm-hmm. of it. I'm from what I was picking up. So it seems lopsided. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also thought, another big point that was criticized, and this one, rightfully so, it was a weird plot point, but so Tinkerbell is in love with Peter here.
Oh, yeah.
And Peter's married. And so they do have, they have a kiss scene later on in the movie when Peter rediscovers his match. Yeah. So it's a weird scene where Tinkerbell essentially blows up into, regular human size versus fairy. And then she makes out with Peter in this nighttime scene. It's on the eve of before they go to battle with Captain Hook. And then she kisses him. And then he's Moira, his wife's name, he's I love Moira. And it's this was a little, because I mean, technically, yeah, he has an affair moment with a fairy who he grew up with. And yeah, that's a weird thing, and do I think that was necessary? No, and I think it's just because it was two of the biggest actors of the time, Robin Williams and Julia Roberts, and they kind of forced that in there. And it's, again, it's another,
I can see that, yeah.
Very much right. Yeah. It's another thing that feels very much a musical trope. You totally see a Tinkerbell song at that mm-hmm. moment where she's expressing her.
Tinkerbell did speak in this one, right? A little bit.
Oh, she speaks a lot. Yeah. I mean, so, So that's the thing. It's not like in the cartoon or the where Tinkerbell's silent. No, she's a regular talk. She's very talkative in it. Like to the point where in the opening scene when the first scene with her when she comes to pick up Peter in London. She's talking and you know, they have this. So no, that's one of the biggest differences between this version and sort of the classic Peter Pan mythology. That's very different. Is that she's very talkative. They have regular dialogue throughout. And again, she's the one who convinces Captain Hook to not kill Peter and the kids initially when Peter's not Peter, he remembers. Yes. And she convinces him to give them 3 days to train Peter and get him back into shape and, you know, resume with the battle.
A little bit off topic. Was this before or after the Mario Brothers movie?
Ooh, good question.
Because a 6-year-old me would have been, oh my gosh, look, it's Mario from that weird movie.
Yep. Let me look that up right now. Let's see. Mario,
because 90s he plays Smee, right?
Bob Hoskins, yep. This was before the Mario 90s movie.
Oh, wow.
Movie.
It
was
okay.
1993.
Okay, so.
1993,
so
yep.
It was flipped then, probably.
But I'm glad you brought that up because I do. That's another thing. I think the cast is pretty
cool. Cast was great.
I love Bob Hoskins as Mr. Smee. Mm-hmm. Maggie Smith is Granny Wendy here, you know, and then Dante Bosco. This was like his big breakout role as Rufio, and he's one of my favorite voice actors of all time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like I got to meet him last year. Rufio was the first thing I said to him, and he was like, bangarang. You know, he was awesome. It's just, and that Rufio is another example of like, this is such a 90s movie because, I mean, here the Lost Boys are, for whatever reason, they have rollerblades. Because again, it's the 90s.
Everyone was rollerblading.
Yes. They're rollerblading here. Rufio's costume and everything is so peak 90s.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, this is a movie I really want to show to my niece. Like, my niece is staying with us this week. I really want to show her if she'll sit through the entire thing. Because I just wonder, is it this going to resonate with kids today? Or is it, you know, pretty of its time? Right. You know, I'm really curious what reaction will be there. So, you know, again, all the criticisms are valid. Is it a perfect movie? By no means. But I also don't think it ever deserved to be blasted in the way it was. Mm-hmm. I think it really does have some pertinent themes to it. And yeah, there's a lot I love about this movie. And again, that scene of the, you're using your imagination, Peter, is one of my all-time favorites. And I love the John Williams score there. It's an absolute blast. So
the lens change from when, like from the rest of the scene to when the frosting shows up on the spoon, there's a different lens used. And that was something that I just picked up on, that I would have only picked up on that on the feeling side of it. But Steven Spielberg is smart to use that for the kids back then, for those of us watching to make it click that there's a switch in Peter's brain into the scene. And now seeing that now is kind of cool that I can catch that now and think of me when I was 6 years old and see how that had affected me. Cause I remember how that felt.
And dude, like, that's one of the things that will make Spielberg forever one of the greatest directors of all time, is just like the way his camera work is so seamless and it really takes you into the world of his movies. That you, like you said, that's the beauty, that's the mark of a great filmmaker, is when you're not even thinking about it because you're so, you feel like you're transported to another world. And he does that because he is such a wizard with camera work. And, you know, he really can immerse you into the story. And he knows exactly what effect an angle will have on a character, on a setting. And like I said, you know, I mean, even thinking about this movie, the transition going from London to first in Neverland, and when we first get to Neverland, Peter Tinkerbell takes him to the pirate ship, and his face is covered with eye patch and all this stuff, and then and he takes it off, and that's when you get to see the pirate ship for the first time through his eyes, right? So through his point of view, and I think that has such a strong effect, you know. Mm-hmm. So again, I mean, this is a movie Yes, I will forever love. It's hard for me to be biased in a way because I grew up on it. I have a deep-rooted nostalgia for it. But I also sincerely enjoy it as an adult. It's one I watch, if I mean, maybe not every year, but I would say every couple years or so, I have to give it a rewatch because it's always a comfort viewing for me. Particularly, I like it around the holidays because it has that kind of like Christmassy feel to mm-hmm. it when, you know, especially because mm-hmm. it's winter time when they're in London. And so it's always just, you know, when I want to just feel good, I turn on this movie. It's just one of those comfort classics. I do, again, recognize the flaws, but also, you know, we mentioned this a little. So obviously parenthood here is a big theme of it. And then, like you said, too, the childlike wonder and, you know, how that can be lost a little bit when you get older mm-hmm. and rediscovering that is really important. Are there any other themes or anything that kind of resonated with you or that stick out?
I got a sense of the motivation for Hook now, which I didn't have before. I just thought he was just the whole bad guy. I haven't seen the whole film, so I don't know. I forgot what is his thing, you know? So, but I would just remember being, oh no, that's Hook and boo.
And I will say, I mean, partly because they get Dustin Hoffman to play it. So, you know, bring in an A-list actor. They try to make it, you know, less cartoonish, but I think with Hook, yeah, he is bent on revenge. He wants to be seen as respectable by those around him, and that's more solidified. If you remember at the end, right before the alligator comes on him, we learn that he's bald. He has
actually.
So a lot of that is, yeah, he's maintaining his honors, and that's why he's so bent on revenge, is because he was humiliated by Peter, who was a boy at the time, when he lost the battle to him all years ago, you know, and then, you know, his hand was eaten by the crocodile and all that. So it's about reclaiming his honor and, you know, putting away that shame he feels. And also on that note, so there is a scene where, and this is probably one of the more problematic ones too, because it is, you know, created in a kind of comedic way, but where Hook is about to kill himself and then he doesn't, but he, you know, he gets like Smee to stop him. And so there, but yes, I think this version of Hook feels very much deep-rooted shame and he has a sense of honor he's trying to reclaim. Yeah. So that's, I'm glad you brought that up. Mm-hmm. And it's why, again, like there's a reason they didn't call the movie Grown Up Peter Pan. They called it Hook, you know, because, Hook and Peter Pan are so interlinked, you know, mm-hmm. and yeah. So it's that was one of the really things interesting about it. But yeah. So I would say, you know, wrapping up here before we get into the question, I would say if you've never seen Hook, I highly recommend, you know, and I would be really curious for people's thoughts on this one, particularly if you didn't grow up on it, mm-hmm. you know, what is your thoughts on it now? Or if you watch it with your family, I think it is a very appropriate family movie. You know, and like, I mean, sure, there's some stuff, but it's very much a PG movie. So it's a good family one to watch. I'd be really curious, like if you have kids, what do they think about it?
I do want to get my kids watching it. You know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just want to, that's what I'm really curious, because I'm so attached to it. I kind of do want to step back and see, okay, what do other people say about it today? Right. If they're watching it, you know, so I, you know, but it will forever be a classic for me. Always one of my feel good ones. And again, I cannot believe I have to talk about it in the Rottenville drive-in series because it should not have this low tomato read, but also, again, in my opinion, Rotten Tomatoes sucks. So that's, you know, I could do a whole episode on that. But anyway, well, Evan, wrapping up here, this was a blast. But, yeah. You know, so we mentioned the movie features some great food in that scene. Once, even though it's technically imaginary, the food we see looks delicious. So if you had a treat or snack that you might not think of for a drive-in theater experience, that might actually be perfect. Do you have anything that comes to mind? I could say mine if you want to think about
it. No, man. This is ironic because we're on the verge of the Fantastic Four, the new Fantastic Four here in 2025. And they are having a promotion with Little Caesars. And back then, Little Caesars was like, I was obsessed with Little Caesars for some reason. Like every Friday, we will get to Little Caesars and then we wouldn't get Blockbuster Game or we watch a movie. So I would have a whole cheese pizza from Little Caesars.
Ooh, that sounds excellent. Yeah, they're just so convenient and yeah, mm-hmm. delicious. But yeah, I think for me, I don't know if it's, you know, because there's a lot of like meats and stuff they show in that scene there. But like, you know, I watching this movie for whatever reason, I could really go for a sub, you know, like from either Jersey Mike's or something like that, you know, like get some like, you know, like particularly like cheesesteak, I think.
Jersey Mike's got some good cheesesteaks.
Yeah, man, they do. Yeah. That's one of my favorites. So I think I would do that, especially since this is a longer movie. I'm like, you know, get a nice sub there and enjoy it. This is because, I mean, if you just get candy, it's going to be gone in 5 minutes and you still got, you know, the whole movie left.
I would watch this at the dine-in theater. I would totally watch this there.
100%. Yeah. Oh, and then if this comes to Alamo, I'm there.
Right. Like, yeah. You know,
there's ones I look out for and I'm like, oh, I would love to see this on the big screen.
Totally. But yeah.
Sweet. Well, Evan, this was a blast as always.
Yeah, it was.
And if it was. Oh, so, and if you're listening out there, please rate and review the show on Podchaser, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. We would love to hear it. Leave us a review, good or bad. Like TJ said on another episode in this series, if it's bad, just please tell us why, because we want to know, you know, what we did wrong. And
good point.
So if we suck, you know, just don't give us just a low rating and then leave it at that. Be honest and give us criticism.
Yeah.
But if you love, same goes if you love us, then, you know, tell us why too, because we want to hear from you.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This was a blast. And yeah, check out the show notes for the playlist of the whole series. And remember, we are all a chosen people, a geekdom of priests. Bangarang.
Hello there, listener. This is Evan Garcia, and I just wanted to jump in here to remind you and to let you know of our Facebook groups and our Discord server. These are great communities where you can post and share memes and talk with the hosts, and we have votes and some polls for future episode topics and fun interactions with our host. So just wanted to remind you that we are focused on community with you listeners, and we love each and every one of you guys listening. Thank you guys.
Hello, Systematic Geekology listeners. This is Kevin here. Just want to give a brief ad for some of the other podcasts in our Anazal podcast network. First of all, off is Let Nothing Move You by Christian Ashley, in which Christian goes through the Bible one chapter at a time and gives his thoughts there. There is also the Bible After Hours, which is a more progressive take on the Bible that tries to challenge the status quo with satire and looks at theology. The host uses the pseudonym The Foulmouth Preacher. And as a bonus, Joshua Knoll does the voices for this one. So definitely check that one out. And also, And We'll Laugh About That Later is the newest podcast that our own Will Rose is starting, where he will interview friends about a story they had that wasn't funny at the time, but that they laugh about now. So definitely check out these shows and subscribe to us wherever you get your pods. Thank you very much.